Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
I'm going to go get started, and as I do, I've got a couple things I want to bring up. So next week's our last week, and what I wanted to do, I'm going to put something up here. If you have phones and would like to do it, I encourage you to. I've got a little QR code here, if you don't mind, if you want to scan that, take a picture, if you want. And what I've got is, it's just a survey to be able to go to a Google Doc thing to just answer two or three questions. Or if you don't want to, it's basically a chance for you to say, hey, is there something we talked about that you wanted to talk more about? Is there something we didn't talk about we wish we did? Or is there something that I've brought up in the class that made you maybe think about it differently than you had before, okay? Because I'd like to take some time next week to do that. If you don't mind doing that, feel free. And if you don't want to use that, want to use paper, Matt and Pam have some paper copies they're going to bring around. If you want to raise your hand, I only have about 50 of them, so everybody can't. So if you, but if you don't mind, you want to do it in print, and then at the first bell, I don't have a pen, but if you want to write down your thoughts, and at the first bell tonight, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and maybe hold your hand up, and I'm going to have them go around, and they're going to gather those at the first bell. So feel free. If you don't, great. If you do, awesome. That's just kind of some feedback, and because next time, if you have suggestions, and I'll put this up at the end of class again, the last few minutes, I'd like to talk about those next week as we wrap the class, and in addition to my final thoughts, to get anything you guys maybe wanted to talk about still that I could address, okay? So that's kind of a chance for you to do so. So I'll put this up again if you like later, but we'll get to that later. So tonight, we are going to kind of pick up where we left off, and I'm going to talk about chapter 8, and the last part of the book, and we're starting to wrap up. We're at the end. Chapter 8 and 9 is kind of a summary of where we've been. We're going to cover chapter 8 tonight, and maybe part of 9. There really are 10 chapters, but chapter 10 is 3 verses, so I don't really count that. And we have verses in the Bible that came later, obviously, by, you know, people who translated it to give us a reference point. And I think I know why, that chapter 10 gives us a few verses to wrap up the story about Mordecai. But we have this chapter next, so we may cover part of 9 tonight, but next week for sure we'll wrap up with the last bit and have some time for some questions and points. But as we get into tonight, this is a summary of where we were. 5 and 6, we had the banquets, so everything was building up to those banquets we had, banquet 1 and 2. Haman and Xerxes get buttered up, and Esther, and one point I want to make, I just want to make sure I'm clear whenever I've said, you know, hey, it's more than God waving a magic wand, you know, I mean that. We certainly have, when we say God's providence, I by no means am trying to say, hey, all these people did this, right, and God's taking credit. By no means. I just think it's way more impactful when we don't put God in a box, right? And Genesis 1, we read about he can do that, and let there be light, and there was. So that's important, too, for him to say, I can and I have. I invented physics, right? That's what he's saying. I invented the laws of which you reply. But then after that, when it's a human story, everything he plays within the rules, right? That's why God is just and merciful. He plays within the system because he leaves no doubt that he is God, and he's showing us that my plans don't ever change. Yours may, but everything you're doing is by my accord. And that's important. So when we look at what Esther's doing, and when I point out things that Esther and Xerxes and we talked about a theology of place last time. It's that idea of God has us exactly where, when, and how we need to be. But that's very important. And Esther is the example. She's the hero of showing us how to do that, right? Of just letting God, let go and let God. So we had the summary of the banquets. We had the insomnia that Xerxes has, where he gets up, and we again have historical evidence he suffered from insomnia. Maybe that was God working on his heart. But he had a problem. His empire's falling apart. He couldn't sleep. So strike while the iron's hot. Esther has him where she wants him. They have the banquets, and I wanted to remind what I would call Haman's no good, very bad day, you know, when he finally meets his end. A couple of things that were important. I talked quickly about how Esther's plan comes through, the ritons, the banquet. You imagine the banquet of the wine banquet. Esther loved his wine. Esther comes through and gets him on the second banquet and says, that's the guy, right? Haman, he's the enemy. Xerxes gets angry. Let's remember, Xerxes is angry because he realizes in that moment Esther has revealed the trap, right? Haman bamboozled Xerxes, right? Haman tricked him in a way into signing, hey, don't worry about it. There's some people to the east or the west that are causing problems. Let me handle it. He gave him the signet ring. It's still Xerxes' fault, but Xerxes has been duped. But Esther knows she's got to do this the right way or Xerxes could kill them both. Who knows, right? So Xerxes is upset. He gets upset. Haman begs her for his life. And her final move is brilliant because this is something I think maybe we don't know as much of, but in history we read about a specific bit of court protocol because remember, Xerxes was king, but protocol was king in Persia. And Esther knows this. For 5 years she's paid attention. She has played the game. She's played the Game of Thrones, right? She knows what to do. And she has one moment, that reclining moment in a special banquet. The king hosts a banquet in chapter 1. But in chiastic structure, we see the end of it coming together. Esther holds what's called the queen's banquet, that reclining figure. It's called the sofre. It's something in history, if you look up, Esther wields this one moment where she knows she can get him. That's a sofre was the name of, and they still today, it's a particular Iranian, rooted in Islam, really more today, but their banquets particularly has to do with a cloth that's spread out, the idea of an inviting you to the table. But it was one of the moments where the queen had some power. The woman in a relationship, even though the king had the power, it was a moment of submission, right? Willing submission. And in that moment, Esther finds herself on the couch. She's guarded by the eunuchs, her guard, who she's built a relationship with. And in that moment, she wields her power and she turns it on its head, theology of place. She enrages Xerxes at the right time. She scares Haman at the right time. And she knows, if I can get him to make a mistake now, because she can't embarrass, you don't want to insult Xerxes, you humiliate him, that's not going to work. But Haman invades her space, he assaults her. Just as Xerxes comes in, little Esther wilts back, and oh, Haman's on me. You know, there's an assault happens, and Xerxes sees it and rages. In that moment, you know, he says, will you even molest her in my house? But in this moment, Esther again, Xerxes is not stupid. He sees what's happening. And we know that because what we're about to read in 8 and 9. He's about to yield the kingdom to Esther and Mordecai because they're all he's got left, okay? But we see that she gets molested by Haman, who falls on her. And the eunuchs quickly jump up and say, hey, we can kill him on the gallows he built for Mordecai. By the way, Mordecai's the guy who saved you. And by the way, that's his niece, right? You got to think, it's all coming at Xerxes quickly. But Xerxes is putting it together too. This is good. This is good. This is politically good for me. You've helped me expose a traitor. Haman tricked me. That's right. He did. We can expose him, right? All these things are coming together. Esther's got to be sweating, right? But she's got her faith in God and all the people that are with her, her eunuchs. And we see that Haman is impaled on his own gallows and Xerxes' fury subsides. And that could be where the story ends, but it's not. Because this isn't a fairy tale, per se. There's still more things to happen. But in this moment, they've won. Maybe she can breathe easily for a moment. And that's where Esther chapter 8 begins tonight. We're going to pick up there. As in Esther 8, we start to see the aftermath. And we're left here. I want you to remember, a banquet has ended. Haman is dead. A little time has passed. And now we have Xerxes, who, let's remember, this broken man, he doesn't have anybody left. His best advisors are dead from the Persian War, or he's had them killed because of jealousy and he's paranoia. His queen, rightful queen, the mother of his children, Vashti, is still banished, right? She's somewhere at another palace. Esther, still here. Mordecai is now present, we're going to see. That's all he's got left. And I want to say, we see that he loves Esther. We do see he has compassion, but at the same time, he didn't have a whole lot of places to turn to. Again, his politics here, right? His empire is falling around him. The people already hate him in history. So we're going to pick up here in 8 because these last two chapters resolve the book. Because now, what do we do? Okay, Haman's dead, but we have a problem to resolve. The decree has been sent, right? And this is where we see Esther still in strength, weep. And we see Jesus weep. We see lots of strong characters. Weeping isn't a sign of weakness, but we see an emotional collapse here by Esther. She's been very strong for for 5 years. But now it's time to act. Esther 8, we'll go ahead and read a few verses here. So, on that day, King Xerxes gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. When the king held out the golden scepter to Esther, Esther rose and stood before the king. And she said, and I want you to pay attention to this, how she addresses him. If it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming for my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred? Then King Xerxes said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows, because he intended to lay hand on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king, and seal it with the king's ring, for an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked. So we have a lot of things happening here. Xerxes, in many ways, is playing along now too. He's telling Esther reciprocity has been fulfilled. We talked about that several weeks. The law of reciprocity. You do the king a favor, he has to do you one. And he will. He doesn't have to go farther than that. And there are legal implications. So we're in kind of a now, what do we do? And I want to talk a little tonight about that edict of the king and the way they have to play this correctly. Because Esther is asking for a chance, right? You can't revoke it. We'll talk some more about that. We've already established that. You can't revoke these things. Now, first of all, and if you look in the first verse, that we do have precedence for this, and I've shown this before, I think, but this is called the Behistun inscription from King Darius, and it's a massive wall on a mountain, on the Mount Behistun in Iran. And all this inscription up there has been translated, and this is a picture of Darius, the father of Xerxes, standing on one of his enemies, and an emblem of a man from each of the satraps he's conquered, kind of a conquering king type thing. And in that, it displays some of these things in text about edicts. It talks about how we can't revoke these things, and it talks about seizing property. So it was, you wonder, why did he give it to Esther? Well, that was Persian protocol too. Once you, this happened a lot, going back to his father's day, every time a rebellion was put down, what'd you do with the property? It was seized and usually given to the nobles, right? Spread the power. That's how they maintained it. Remember, ancient Persia is the first real modern superpower. We got to remember that. It's not Babylon and Assyria, all that stuff. They were strong, but they didn't have this government, right, that Persia does. You throw a little dash of ancient Persia, ancient Rome, and Greece in there, and you get kind of what America looks like eventually, right? As far as the precepts, the way they built things on that, states and rules and rights, and it was the early days of that, and they did so by keeping all 127 satrapies balanced, right? And the way you kept them happy is when you put down a rebellion, you paid the people who were loyal to you. And usually they went first to the royals. There were several liar kings and traitors. If you betrayed the king, you were considered a liar king or a liar noble. You have to tell the truth as a Persian, right? And Haman now has been busted for telling a lie, right? He lied to Xerxes. He didn't tell him a whole truth. That's how this is being spun. But we know there's precedent, so he gives the estate, and when you give the estate to someone, they get all the people that were in it, right? They own them now. And she has a house there, too. And she owns all their assets. So she has access to all that Haman owned. Now, he was wealthy, but remember, that money he was going to have put into the treasury when he said, Xerxes, let me kill these people, was going to come on the heads of the Jews, right? Tribute money. But for now, Esther has won his attention, okay? Now, in the second verse, we see about the signet ring. Coming back to that, signet rings were important. We've talked about that. But the signet ring was everything in this day and age for these people, okay? Most people had them. any, that's how you stamped letters, that's how you did papyrus, but it was also a symbol of your power. And it quite literally, who held that was, you didn't question it. The kings, whoever wielded that was essentially the king's proxy. That's it, end of story. And so to do that, we see other examples from the Old Testament, other cultures. Genesis, the Pharaoh takes his signet ring off, gives it to Joseph. You know, we see the signet ring on my right hand, I would pull you off, Jeremiah says. Set me as a seal upon your heart, Song of Solomon. That term for a seal and the idea of sealing has always been important, especially in ancient cultures. And, you know, we have some examples. So this was the seal of Darius. We know that from archaeology. This was a one put in from him with a bow. The one in the middle was from a Persian noble. We're not sure. But these were all from something called the Oxus treasure, which is in the British Museum, which is found on the Oxus River. And this one here, cleaned up very well, preserved very well. And it's written in Aramaic. It says like Bahashta or something like that. It's a person's name, a random person. Don't really know who it is, but this was common. And it's got the Lamassu, that's the Lamassu. It's like a lion, horse, winged thing with a human head. That was the symbol of Persian nobility. So these kind of things were common. Xerxes would have had one like this. And if you saw it, that's the king's. Right? So that was very important. If you had the signet ring, you were the voice of the king. So it's very important now that Mordecai has it. Very important, okay? This is not just an official, this is the official. Back to verse 3 to 6, looking over that, I want to point out a couple things too. This is the first time, as far as we can tell, that Xerxes finds out that Esther is a Jew, right? It really wasn't till now, because it says she calls Mordecai, this is the guy, by the way, I'm his niece, he's a Jew. Put two and two together. So it's all happening fast for Xerxes. Oh, right? I see. So in these first verses, and it is something a lot, again, I'm pointing out things that historians a lot of times will say, well, this is why this couldn't have happened. But it does if you actually read history. There were other times where Persian kings married non-Persians. They were just very flexible in calling who was a Persian. They would capture certain satraps and then make them Persians and marry them. There was a famous Cambyses, Xerxes' brother, who married an Egyptian princess and passed her off as somebody else. So they did what they wanted, right? There's no precedent for that. So having her as a Jew wasn't a major problem, or a Jewess, but remember, she was queen, but not the mother of his heirs. So as long as she was not the queen, that's why we probably think she was just kind of the head concubine, right? But she was his favorite. She was his queen. So she still had power, okay? But we see Esther's emotions pour out here, right? She's still humble. She weeps at his feet, but she's doing protocol. Her demeanor compared to Haman, while a much prettier face, for sure. Also, look how she's buttering him up, though. She leans into it. Not like Haman. If it pleases you, and I love how she does, looks how she closes with, and if you're pleased with me, because it's kind of given, you tell me you're not happy with me now? You have to know she's turned the eyes on a little bit now, because she's got him. I mean, she's telling him, I just saved your life, too. I just maybe saved your political career for a few more years. This guy was bad news for you, okay? He knows that. He has a fresh slate. So reciprocity is given. So he's telling them when he says, okay, Esther, I gave you Haman's house. I've given you eye for an eye, okay? The rest of it you're going to have to do. Write another decree. Because in 7 and 8, Mordecai and Esther know what's going on here. The Persian king was still subject. When we know this from other examples, in Ezra, which happens a little later, precedent from earlier kings and kings in the future. Ezra, if you go read 5 and 6, reflects Persian protocol very well. If you remember what happens there, basically the son of Artaxerxes, his son, gets complaints from governors saying, hey, the Jews are rebuilding the temple. Are you sure they're supposed to be doing that? And they say, well, hold on. And these were people that wanted their heads, but they went through protocol, and it tells them, Ezra, they dig around, they go to the palace of Ectabana, and they dig up the old archives of Xerxes, say, yep, says they could do it. Pass it on, they say, okay. So they were very litigious people. However, we see this pressure on the Jews over and over again, right? They never leave them alone, which is why this is dangerous. Just constantly badgering the Jewish people. They're going to cause a problem. They rebelled against them. Better watch them. So they were an easy target. And we know they existed, and I'm building up to this because, you know, we know the Jews right now are sort of spread out. There was a province called Yehuda that they had their own coinage for them. It's called the Yehuda coins, and it says in Aramaic, Yehuda there. So the Jews were in one place, but they were also scattered. Okay, and this is important for why Xerxes does what he does. Okay? And in 8, we see he tells them again, you know, you cannot revoke law. So what can we do? It's over, right? He says you can't revoke a previous law, and that was Persian tradition. And there were a few reasons for that, which I've got listed here. Because remember, the kings were perfect. If the king made a law, that it was law. The gods wanted it to be. If we have to overturn it later, it was still right at that time, but we need to add to it. So you could amend, but you could never overturn. It created a lot of problems, you can imagine, right? But they always found a way out of it. But they had to be careful with how they worded the law. This is a major problem for Xerxes because this one affects his wife, and how are they going to get out of this? Well, here's the thing. If Xerxes does, and I've seen arguments, you know, about Persian protocol, if he does try to come back and say, well, I'm gonna announce a law that says ignore that. Other kings tried it and they got overthrown because that's admitting you're weak. You weren't right. The king's perfect, right? You must not be the true king. Overthrow him with this noble. It happened. Xerxes already had a dubious claim to the throne. Remember that. When he took over as king, he wasn't the older brother. He kind of did some finagling with when he was born and convinced them to make him king. So he was already kind of on dubious ground here. And if he looks weak now, his people are just going to riot. So he needs a solution within the law. And Esther, his wife, thank goodness he didn't get rid of her, has given him a way out, right? And now this is the first time in this book Xerxes does something right. The only time he does something right. When he listens to her and Mordecai, and the only time he yields his power. He says, take my ring, write a decree, do what you need to do. When he gets out of the way and lets those two work, that's when the magic happens, right? And we do have, you know, a lot of people read this and say, well, if he revokes this, and he did this, according to what it says, Mordecai, they wrote this letter, and it went out to the provinces on these fast horses and all this stuff. Can they do that? Well, yes, they had the road system for it, which is going to be used by the Romans later, leads us up to Christianity and the apostles able to travel. Haman's edict happened about 2 months ago. If you want to know where we're at in the story, it's been about 2 months since Haman did a thing, and now the Jews still have about 10 months left to prepare, right? They have to be fast. So let's read on a little more here, the next 5 verses. So after Xerxes tells them what to do, in verse 9, it says, the king's scribes were summoned at that time in the 3rd month, which is the month of Shivan, on the 23rd day. Okay. And an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded concerning the Jews to the satraps and the governors and the officials of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, all 127 provinces, to each province in its own script and to each people in its own language, and also to the Jews in their script and their language. And he wrote it in the name of King Xerxes and sealed it with the signet ring. Okay, that's how we know what's about to happen is this is legitimate and they have to follow this. He sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud. Usually may say the royal horse or mare, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods on one day throughout all the provinces of King Xerxes, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. A copy of what was written was to be issued as a decree in every province, being publicly displayed to all peoples, and the Jews were to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. So the couriers, mounted on their swift horses that were used in the king's service, rode out hurriedly, urged by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. So they're given a chance to fight back. It's also important here he replies to both Esther and Mordecai, right? They're both, he's telling them, you guys are both, here you go. Here's the signet ring. Queen, uncle, Mordecai, I guess you're my uncle now. You know, he said, you guys got this. I'm giving it to you. And it's smart because Mordecai knows and Esther both know how to do this. So they come up with a decree to let them defend themselves. That's really clever, right? Because they can't overturn it, but what they can do is say, let us defend ourselves. Now you might say, well, that sounds silly. I've always read over that. I mean, who's going to stop them? Where's the military? They're not going to step in. Why? Well, there's precedent for this in Persian history. So back to our calendar. This is back when in Nisan, the month of Nisan, where we had the problem with Haman. He does his thing a couple of months ago. We're in the month of Shivan, so it all matches, which we're almost in May. So we're about the time of the season of year this would have happened. So when they give this decree, they've got about 9 months to get ready for what's coming. So they have time, okay? So knowing that, there's a few things about the courier system. Now, what's interesting is history tells us this too. I've shown you this map a few times. This is Persia, and it's small. But that whole empire from east to west was about 3,000 miles east to west. 2.1 million square miles if you take the whole area, the whole thing that spread north and south. The Royal Road is something, if you read about in history, was built from Susa to Sardis, one of the first massive roads. And if you took that road, they built courier posts every 15 miles. They had a whole beacon system of riders. And Herodotus confirms this. Normal people riding on horse, whatnot, taking the other roads, it took you about 3 months to go from west to east if you just did nothing but travel. But on the Royal Road, several sources confirm that with the king's horses traveling that, they could do it in 10 days, okay? It's wild. And the thing about that, I kept thinking, is this one of those exaggerations? But there's a ton of corroborating evidence for this. And some of it was the king's horses. And we do know from saddlebags that were preserved, things were preserved, rubbings, just the kind of horses they had. That is one thing we can know. These were horse people. These were the best horses in the world, right? These horses were amazing, okay? And the courier system, by all accounts, worked very well. So it definitely, and when it tells us the king lets them use them, notice Haman, if you go back and read chapter 3, it just says he sent them out. The king didn't send the good stuff, okay? These are the king's military horses. They were used twice, we know of in history, outside of this, in the Battle of Marathon, when Xerxes was trying to find out from the war front what was going on, and he used the fast super horses he had to ride out and say, hey, we won this battle. Whoops, we lost that battle, right? When they beat the 300 Spartans, the horses came back, and then they got word through those horses that they were beaten at Marathon. So the king used these sparingly. So giving them to Esther and Mordecai is a big deal. So they used the best horses, and they travel. Again, they were these express horses. We know that, and this is where they got the postal service started we have today. That's Herodotus records the first account of using the words, you know, they delivered mail in hail, sleet, storm. That's where the post office gets that saying, by the way. So this is kind of an interesting fact. So looking at those verses, 9 to 14, we see a new decree being made that turns a rebellion, okay, a revolt of Jewish people that Haman claimed, into what is effectively a state-sanctioned civil war. Think about that. That's what he's sanctioning, okay? The crown is basically saying the first ordinance stands. Those Haman's, the people Haman sent it out to, they have the right to round you up and kill you. But I have a decree that says you can defend yourself. Now, that's a big deal because you think about why I sanction that. Well, a few reasons. And we have evidence. And I wanted to look real quick at this. If you compare Haman and Mordecai's edicts, I just want to, don't let this be lost on you. And you can go back and read 3:13 and then 8:11 here. But the wording is very similar, right? On purpose. Mordecai and Esther use the same language because remember, Mordecai has a copy. Remember that? Don't miss that. He has a copy of the secret bribe, right? That's important. That's why God's got him where he needs him. And so he does it word for word, but he just changes the names, right? We're going to flip the tables. The Jews get to defend themselves. We get to kill anybody and their families that take, and we get to take your stuff, right? Now, they don't. They do defend themselves and kill many people. But in defense, they don't loot and plunder. And note that it says the exact day is going to be on that day. I've never seen the movies The Purge. You may have heard of those, like horror movies where I've read the synopses, and I know I've talked to friends who've seen them, but it's a movie about where it's set in the future, you know, and there's one day a year where the government sets aside and just closes their doors and says, any crime goes tonight, and you won't be punished for it. That's their way of dealing with undesirable people. And the next day, they just sort of get back to business. That's kind of what this was. Other times in the Persian Empire, they would do this to handle their problems. So there was precedent to do this. And we have evidence from Ezra. We see some other complaints about Jews uprising during Xerxes' reign. If you read Ezra 6 and 7, the people complain about the Jews being a problem. They've always been a problem. We need to do something about it. They're rebellious. Other satraps were rebellious. So a lot of pressure was always coming at the Jews. But we have other state-sanctioned civil wars. And it's foreign to us today to maybe think of that. But you have to think about Persia. If you think about it, the U.S., it's sort of like this. Imagine you've got the federal government, and each state in America is a satrap, right? It's a province. in the way that they sort of let them govern themselves. And you might be thinking, well, that's what we state rights. It's not the same thing as states. What they would do is there was a conflict. This is how they kept order for so long. They'd say, Alabama, Mississippi, if you guys have beef with each other, what you had to do was go to the king, say, we want to fight it out, and somebody's going to not stand for this. And the king would say, I sanction it. Okay, it's good. Nobody else intervene. The federal government's not going to bail you out, but you guys can fight. Makes sense? That's how they did it. And it maintained order for a long time. And so what they would have were these satraps, if the king had reason, and we have some I won't go into for time's sake, but there's a story, if you look up, about King Darius and a man named Oroetes. The short version is, when Darius was in the War of Succession to become king, at the time, he was not confirmed to be king, and he was compelling people to take sides with him. But there was a man on the far western coast called Oroetes who decided he backed the wrong horse. He didn't get behind him, and Darius warned him, you need to back me up. And he rebelled against Darius when Darius did become king. Well, Darius, the short version is that he sent three letters to this guy and said, that's fine, you can do what you want. I have three letters for you. And he goes out there and he sends a sanctioned letter that says, I think the first letter says, the people I'm sending from this satrap, I'm sanctioning them to kill you and to take your land. Says, okay, I defend myself. The second letter is, by the way, all the guards, you're not allowed to defend him. So all the guards say, what? And so in fear, all of his soldiers lay down their weapons and leave. And then the third letter was, you can fight back, but nobody can fight with you. So, you know what I mean? So he worked it legally. It's kind of silly, but that's how they did it. They gave decrees to make you legally give up. So they would have these state-sanctioned wars. And that's what's happening here. Esther's asking for one of these, really. Let us have a chance. And Xerxes is saying, you can do it. And that's what this edict does, if you read it slowly. It's basically saying in 1 year, the king says, you can fight us, we can fight you. And the king is going to close the gates of the Susa. And that has to happen. That's what happened in history. All the other provinces, and if you're an enemy of the Jews, you can fight. But also, one of them's the queen, right? Do what you want to do, right? But he's letting them do it. And we see some take him up on it. So we have conflicts between these satraps. I sort of went through this already. It was the idea of rebellion versus sanctioned war. And I'll say also for this chapter, as we wrap the chapter, I'll put this map up. Another reason Xerxes said yes to this, he was in bad shape if he didn't, because there was something unique about the Jews. Historically, we can verify. The thing about the Jews, there's a bunch of them, right? And the problem with the Jews is they've been kind of kicked around for a long time. They were transported through Nebuchadnezzar's reign to Persia, what became Persia. But this whole area, remember, these are all satraps, east to west, okay? Right now, this is a version of the map with the satrapies, okay? Not to be, don't want to confuse you, but in this area, each one of these is a province, okay? Bactria, all these ones we can look at. On the far west, I've got the circle in the wrong place, but right here is where Jerusalem is, Israel, okay? It's still there, quote unquote, but not really, right? Now, Cyrus has already let the Jews go home. Here's a better map of it. Right here, there's a province called Eber-Nahri, okay? So this is the whole empire, Libya, Africa, over the way to India. There's Greece. Over here is where the capital is. This is where Susa is. Now, the Jews are over here in a province called Eber-Nahri. The province of Yehuda was so small, it was just a subsection of this one. That's how broken they are. Even with Nehemiah's confirmation that the people were allowed to go back, there were only at this time, through their census, about 40,000 Jews present. The Persian Empire, by their accounts, they had 50 million people in the Persian Empire. That was half the world's population at that time. Okay? The problem is, unlike the other provinces, the Jews were different. When Persia took over, these were all peoples who lived in these nation states. The Jews were brought over, right? So 40,000 of them went back to Yehuda, Jerusalem. Where were the other ones at? Census says there were about 1 million Jews scattered throughout the empire. They were different. So the problem is, when you put down a revolt out there, it's fine. But when it turns into that, that's what's about to happen. The Jews aren't like the Medes. They're not like the Bactrians. They don't live in one state. The Jews are everywhere. So this is different. When Esther and Mordecai say, we want one that we can fight back, and we'll organize. And when we organize and we do it right, it's going to be bad, right? So this is a different military campaign. Xerxes knows it. And he's going to let them have a shot, and they have a pretty good one. Because now that they have legal authority to fight back, and Persia won't intervene, now they have a chance because Esther had them fast throughout the empire. They have a queen that's one of their own now, running the most powerful empire. Now's their chance to take back theirs. Not just out west, but now they're seeing what it is to live throughout an entire world and be Jews somewhere outside of Jerusalem. And all these represent the Persian Jews all throughout the empire. And you might think, why do... So this little map here, if you do, you have a civil war, well, Xerxes, what are they going to do to you? Here's the thing about Susa. What they would do, this is a topographical map from UNESCO World Heritage Foundation, which is why it looks kind of crazy, geomap. Right here is the map I showed you before of the Persian capital. When we started the class, I showed you a floor plan of the capital. That's just the citadel, okay? That whole region here, the rest of that map, Susa, this is the city of Susa, city of craftsmen. This was part of Susa, right? The whole city goes all over here, right? The palace is right here. Xerxes is going to close his doors and let chaos reign, right? So that's why he would do it. We do see in chapter 9 that when they do fight back, they do kill some people in Susa, but most of the fighting is out in the provinces, okay? So we get to the end here after they set their plan. And in verse 15, I think it's the bell. And by the way, if any of you have a sheet that you filled out, if you don't mind holding it up, and I think Pam or Matt will come and get it. If you don't have one, that's fine. They'll come grab it from you. But otherwise, I'll put the QR code back up at the end. Anybody? So the last couple of verses of 8, then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday, and many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. We see here in 15, I put this slide up the other day with a few edits, that, excuse me, when you see this, the Persian royal gifts, the concept of that, Mordecai is clothed in royalty, garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold and purple fine linen. Accounts of the kings of Persia from Herodotus tell us their garments were noteworthy beyond all luxury. He wore purple-edged tunics woven with white center, gold on their head, which seemed a golden belt wrapped around them, and had a scimitar with a sheath made with a single gem, a headdress, and a robe of purple, blue, and white. Having blue and white inlaid robes was reserved only for royalty. That Tyrian shell I told you about, the Tyrian mollusk that they would get off the coast of Tyre in Phoenicia, that's what it looks like. And it had these beautiful shades in its shell, and the blood from it actually could be dried. The tissue would actually turn various shades of that. So anytime you see the colors of these ancient blues and purples and reds, it's from this and that royal purple, right? Tyrian blue and white, that was the king's highest favor. And we know from, this is from a Persian fashion sort of book about people who research the history, that silks and fine wools, purples and crimsons, blues, these were for royalty or high nobility. And that's Mordecai now. Fine linens and blues, right? So it's a beautiful thing to have those sorts of things given to you. And we see in 15 and 16, I do want to point out, it's kind of funny as we wrap, Haman was not a popular man, right? Nobody weeps for Haman here. The city of Susa held a joyous celebration because they had clarity, right? They had a vision. Haman was dead, and there were a lot of Jews in Susa, okay? For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. And in the last verse, I think it's interesting, we see one of maybe the first instances of people converting, right? In a way, now history probably says these people are like, hey, let's get on the winning side. But the last verse is sort of funny. It says, other nationalities became Jews because they were afraid, right? Many converted and adopted their identity. But this is important. This is God's plan, right? He's getting this whole land set up of people learning about who he is. Sides are chosen. We see as we go into chapter 9, as we close next week, nobody's really sure what Xerxes is up to. Two sides are allowed to fight. Who do we back, right? And you have people deciding as we get into chapter 9. It's going to tell us that the governors, the administrators, every one of them, most of them sided with the Jews because they were like, I'm not going to fight them. So they had to take their chances one way or the other. Well, we only have a couple of minutes. I'm going to leave this back up if you want to take that survey at all. Leave me some comments for next week. We're going to close the class next week. It's been fun. I've enjoyed it. It's been educational for me. And next week, we're going to do chapter 9. And go through the events here. It's the last chapter, really, and kind of cover that. And I'm going to go over some of my closing points, and I'd like to take any comments you have and work those in. And if there's something you want to talk more about, I'll be happy to address next week. But chapter 9 will see us go into the execution of this plan. We're going to jump forward in time 9 months, and we're going to see how it all kind of goes down. And we will definitely talk about how Purim is established and how the Feast of Purim is still celebrated today, and how Esther has been all about leading us to Jesus. So, well, we'll stop there. Thank y'all for your time tonight.